You know, I think that food is very powerful. You know, despite the languages and the cultural backgrounds we are from, food can be a social glue that ties people together and really celebrate that colors, not only in the vegetables and fruit, but also colorful cultures that we have in USA. So we have been the first veggie chip to have ever been featured on the Michelin Guide because of our sustainable story, as well as the culinary cultures that we use in our snacks.
Welcome to the Brands for a Better World podcast, the podcast that brings you the stories behind people and products building a more just, healthy, and regenerative future for us all. Tune in weekly, and together, we'll learn why these better products and brands were created, how they're helping fix broken systems, and what you can do to support them. My hope is that you'll discover some new brands to love and get some sparks of inspiration that will help you live your best life. Hi, I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow to scale their impact. This podcast is one way we do that. If you like the show, please help it grow by leaving ratings and reviews on your podcast app and by sharing your favorite episodes with your friends. Maybe this will be one of them. On this episode, I'm speaking with Betty Liu, CEO of Confetti, about her 3 years traveling the globe looking for food and cultural inspiration, how she came up with the idea for her colorful veggie chips and got seed funding to test the idea, why her products are better for people and the planet, and what her biggest lessons learned are after 6 years of building this brand. Then we wrap up with a fun rapid round question segment. Enjoy.
Hey Gage, very excited to be here. And I'm Betty, the founder of Confetti Snacks, and we are here creating gourmet award-winning snacks from diverse cultures around the world to celebrate vegetables and fruit and also resolve major problems facing the world today like food waste and hunger.
And I just realized when you made that intro that Betty and Confetti rhyme.
Yeah, it does. So that's people call me Betty Confetti in my team. It's really funny.
Really? That's great. One of our clients, Mama Chia, her husband was one of the partners in the business for a long time, and they would call him Papa Chia because it's just, yeah, funny. Anyway, one of the things I was realizing when I was researching to figure out what parts of your story to tell is that you spent 3 years traveling around the world, just exploring food and culture and so much more. The reason I thought that was interesting is that before starting my agency Modern Species, I took a year off and traveled and explored and food and culture, et cetera, too. So I learned a lot from that. And a lot of those lessons are what I put behind Modern Species and how we run it today. So I'm curious, 3 years, that's three times longer than I did it. What did you learn from that trip? Why did you take the trip and what did you take away from that trip?
I find that travel is really inspiring. You know, I think a lot of ideas would have materialized, you know, just based on the kind of things that you see and experience. And, you know, I come from a really tiny island country called Singapore. It's a dot on a world map and most people don't know where it is. It's really tiny and you drive from one end of Singapore to the other in about 45 minutes. You have about 5.6 million people in it. You know, there are so many cultures and nationalities living in Singapore. And, you know, I've always been very curious about the world. I wanted to see more, you know, beyond Singapore and really experience what the world is like. So I took about 3.5 years at 27 years old and decided to do a mini retirement and just see as much as I can. I got to see about 50 countries and learn so much. You know, despite language differences, I feel like food is a major connector, and really experiencing different beauty and challenges in the world has opened up my eyes to open up to different richer perspectives. And I do feel like, you know, a lot of founders, including like GoPro, you know, a lot of founders wouldn't have gotten their ideas unless they have been inspired by certain parts of their trip.
Well, that's funny. We were the same age when we did our trips because I was 27 also. And we were also calling it a mini retirement type of thing. Our trip was inspired after reading The 4-Hour Work Week, in that Timothy Ferris kind of talks about like how we so often wait until we're 65 or 70 to try to go live our dream life of golfing all the time or traveling the world or whatever. But by that time, you know, theoretically, our bodies are a little bit more tired, our interests have changed, and maybe we don't want to go do all that stuff. So why not take mini retirements throughout your life instead? So we're inspired by that. And just sold everything and quit our jobs and went and traveled for a little bit.
Wow, that must have been amazing.
Similar age, so. I mean, not as amazing as your trip, but it was pretty awesome. And I did learn a lot that kind of informs our business today. But how many countries did you say you visited?
About 47. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, but there are like almost 200 countries in the world. So I think it's just at the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more I want to see. And I'm a very creative person. So I can't really create unless I have good input. And travel gives me that creative input so that it ideates more ideas. Better ideas.
Since that trip, do you still travel a lot?
Yes, I do, but more within US now because I'm based here. And, you know, US is such a big country. Every state is almost like its own country. They are all different very culturally. Like the Bay Area would be so different from Wyoming, for example. It's good that I can work remotely and really, you know, I think it's the precedence of a brand new era of like travel entrepreneurs. Like, I call it travelpreneurship, where you are just like absorbing everything around you and different talent and landscapes, and then you are putting on out richer output as well because of what you see.
Yeah, one of our team members is a full-time, he calls it digital nomad, where he just kind of works remotely, but he travels around the world and can work from co-working spaces or his Airbnb or coffee shops or whatever. But I love the travelpreneur kind of idea, because to your point, there are some people who travel and have a job and it's just flexible and lets them work wherever. But I think a lot of the people I know who travel regularly are entrepreneurs in some way. Like they have their own entities, maybe even three or four different projects that they're working on. Then they just kind of divide the time up amongst those projects. So there's like this nice tight community of location independent professionals and or expats or whatever in all these different hubs like Portugal or other places that are popular for people to congregate. And it builds this nice entrepreneurial spirit of a bunch of people who are A, worldly, love traveling, love experiences, love culture, but also happen to be trying to build something. So it's a really cool kind of community that's being built around that kind of travelpreneur side of things.
Absolutely. And I think specifically relevant to me as well, because I'm a snack founder. When I go to different places like US, different states, different places in Europe, I also see how brands market themselves in the same snack category. So that's very helpful as well. Like how do they display something or merchandise something? You know, what kind of initiatives work better in the different continents? So I do feel like it's actually very enriching as a snack.
Right. Probably flavor profiles too, right? Because I think it's Canada that loves ketchup flavored chips. Whereas in the US, like I think most people would be like, what? Ketchup flavored chips? But I'm sure we have our own weird flavored stuff here that in another country, people would be like, what? Pickle beer or something weird like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for US, we are creating like Hawaiian barbecue that we are going to launch with Disney and Mickey Mouse this fall. And then there's, you know, we are also getting inspiration from the South, like Mississippi and, you know, soul food, Creole, African Creole flavors, like Cajun spice. I love shrimp and grit, and I love like tasting the different food cultures in US itself as well. You know, it's so rich with food cultures and a synergy of different cultures around the world.
Absolutely. I love the Cajun spiced food. I'm just a big spicy food fan, so I love that about Cajun food. So I'm excited for you to launch that in the near future. I noticed in your LinkedIn history that it seemed like the dates kind of aligned, whereas pretty much as soon as you got back from this 3-year trip, you launched Confetti. So what was the inspiration and motivation behind launching? Was it something you saw or learned during your travels, or was this an idea you already had? And when you got back, it was just time to start it.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 9-year trip. So I was supposed to see like every country in the world, but then I cut it short after one quarter is done because, you know, I was hiking in British Columbia. I was so impressed by the scenery there. It's really stunning. It kind of looks like New Zealand, but it's like magnified by 100 times. So I was actually strolling in Garibaldi Provincial Park. I was mountain climbing there, looking at this really beautiful turquoise glacial lake, really struggling to find a good snack to bring up the mountains with me. You know, I carry a rucksack, and as much as I hike very light, you know, carrying apples and fruit is very heavy. Protein bars were very bland and boring, and then potato chips gave me a sore throat. So I started making my own snacks by visiting farmers markets in British Columbia, you know, dehydrating it and baking it in my own oven and sharing it with neighbors and friends who loved it. So I noticed that, you know, food is a medium to reach people, to touch people, and it creates a lot of joy as well when I see people happy because of something I created. So that made me stop my travel, go back to Singapore, pitch the Singapore government, who gave us the first check to start this company. And I really wanted to, yeah, create something that's scalable. But I know that I need the right investors. I need the right team and talent. To make it scalable, I need cash as well. So that's why I stopped the world trip and I did a business plan and pitched it to the government.
That's amazing, A, that you were inspired in that way. I've heard, I know at least a couple other brands off the top of my head that were inspired similarly. One is Yum Butter. One of the co-founders came up with the idea while he was traveling because he needed to carry a convenient, easy food with him. And like nut mixes, like nut butters made sense to him because they're, you know, protein packed, easy to carry, etc. But he liked flavors. So he started mixing like local flavors of whatever place he was traveling in into the nut butter. So he made like spicy Asian nut butters or cranberry and coconut nut butters. And so when he got done with his travels, he came back and launched that as a company. So Hale Snacks, same kind of story. Like they were always going on hikes and wanted to take a healthy, delicious snack with them. But like most of the nut mixes and trail mixes were either not flavored or just boring flavors. So they came up with more exciting, like chef-crafted flavors of nut snacks and launched their company. So that's cool. It's kind of a similar trend is like, you found a problem, you experienced a problem like, oh, I can't find anything that fits my need. And then you realize other people have that same problem. So I'm going to solve that problem by launching my own company.
Yeah. And I really love the brands you mentioned. And, you know, Sahali made such a good, I think there's still a lot of innovation, even though something is commoditized for a very long time. Like nuts is a commodity, but to elevate it through a brand, I think that's the most fascinating part. Like, you know, the brand becomes the emotional connection to consumers. And you are right, you know, a lot of brands start from a need. And, you know, my need is that I need a creative outlet. And at the same time, I wanted a perfect snack that I can bring up the mountain that showcase my heritage. And as a Singaporean, we are all foodies. We take our food very seriously. Yeah, how can we channel that into a snack?
Yeah, and to your point, just like nuts that are kind of a commodity. So are fruits and vegetables, right? So you found a similar way to level up those fruits and vegetables into a craveable, convenient snack as well. I didn't know Singaporeans were all foodies, though. That's really cool. Maybe I need to go visit there because that's whenever I travel, my whole agenda, travel itinerary is based on finding all the best like restaurants or snacks or breweries or, you know, whatever. I just go and try to find the best things I can eat. So I imagine if Singaporeans are foodies, there's probably lots of great restaurants there too.
Yeah, that's our major and probably like, you know, our major source of entertainment. Like Singapore has no natural resources. Americans are very spoiled. You know, you have the Grand Canyon, you have Alaska, you have beautiful mountains and, you know, people can really enjoy like natural attractions. But Singapore is just an island and it's full of skyscrapers. And, you know, food culturally is very important to us. And even our street food is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We love our food and we take it seriously. And there are a lot of Michelin restaurants there as well. I think the cultural influence, because we get so many people from around the world, the influences from the different cultures from East and West really melts together in a beautiful culinary melting pot.
Really need to go. I'm getting excited to go visit. Another thing you mentioned, though, is that you went home and pitched the government to get some funds to start the business. Did you already know there were grants available for entrepreneurs in Singapore? Or did you get back and you were just looking for ways to start it and somebody recommended a grant?
I know that the Singapore, you know, they really focus on innovation. You know, although we have one of the largest sovereign funds in the world, but we have no oil and gas like the Middle East or oil cartels or no natural resources at all. So the only resource we have is human talent. And that's why the government plays a lot of support for innovation and young entrepreneurs. They didn't really care whether I was male or female. It's completely, they don't regard race in any sense. They only focus on, you know, how well is this person going to execute in the market? You know, is this concept scalable? You know, can it really shine on the world stage? And that's what they care about. So pitched them and they told me to find a mentor for 1 year, which I found. And basically, we managed to, you know, create a minimum viable product, launch it in different farmers markets, pop-ups, festivals. People really loved it. And after we got a minimum proof of concept, we started getting in venture capital funds from US and Asia so that we can scale this further and really scale this up to major supermarkets.
Wow, that's amazing. So was their main goal for you to build a business that would operate and provide, you know, snacks in Singapore? Or was the original goal like, hey, prove your concept here, but then we want you to scale in Europe or US or wherever, and we'll help you fund that?
Yeah, the latter. I think that the government is as ambitious as me. You know, we are not interested in anything less than world domination. So Singapore is great to prove the concept. It's small enough to test something and to know whether it works. And then once we know it works, then let's move to a bigger playground. And US is the biggest consumer and snack market in the world. The demographic is affluent and people care about something better for you and better for the planet. We felt like that was the next natural decision. After we proved it in all the supermarkets in Singapore, you know, what's next? So I migrated to US last summer and I'm based here now permanently so that we can grow in a much larger market.
Nice. Okay, great. That's amazing. So we've talked a lot about your inspiration for the company and how you got it started, but we haven't explicitly said all of what you're selling. So can you tell our listeners what your products are and maybe kind of mention some of the flavors that you've got and then talk a little bit about why they're better for the world, why they're healthier or more sustainable, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. So we take ugly produce. You know, I travel around the world and I noticed that there's so much beauty in the world, but there's also a lot of challenges. Like 2.9 trillion pounds of edible produce are thrown away every year. It's about 1/3 of edible produce, while 8.6 million people die of hunger or starvation every year. It's two very big injustices. You know, it's not that the world is not producing enough vegetable and fruit. It's more like we are not using what we have produced in an efficient way. There's a very big bottleneck and there are really strong supply chain inefficiencies that exist right now in our food ecosystem. So how can we elevate these ugly produce and turn them to gourmet award-winning snacks that is not only delicious, but colorful, adventurous, and fun to eat? At the same time, you know, bring cultures together. Can we celebrate diversity? You know, after the pandemic, there was a lot of Asian hate. There were people who have gotten beaten to death just because they were Asian. There was the Black Lives Movement issue that was happening as well. You know, I think that food is very powerful. You know, despite the languages and the cultural backgrounds we are from, food can be a social glue that ties people together and really celebrate that colors, not only in the vegetables and fruit, but also colorful cultures that we have in USA. So we have been the first veggie chip to have ever been featured on the Michelin Guide because of our sustainable story, as well as the culinary cultures that we use in our snacks. We got voted Best Gourmet Snack Brand of the Year by APAC Insider. And I really wanted a brand that was very inclusive and really inspired by all the amazing cultures I've explored in the world trip. So there's like Japanese teriyaki, veggie chips made from carrots, radishes, mushrooms, okra. Can I create the ultimate anti-potato chip? And potato chips dominate 95% of the snack market share. Extruded corn puffs as well. You know, they are nutritionally bankrupt. In fact, the most of the snack aisle is just one color. Everything is beige and there's like, it's nutritionally bankrupt and we don't want that. So can we like reverse the conversation and make people look at snacks differently? So this is snack 2.0 where everything is colorful. It's real vegetables. We bake it. And can we make vegetables fun to eat and fruits fun to eat? So we have teriyaki from Japan, truffle from Europe, tandoori from India, and green curry from Thailand. We work with Michelin-starred chefs, James Beard Award-winning chefs, in order to respect the cultures that we got inspired by. So if we are going to do a green curry, you know, we need to make sure the top, middle, and base notes, exquisite flavors, the herbs and spices that they use, the actual recipe of the culture is respected. And, you know, we went through hundreds of rounds of experimentation to make sure that it's amazing in terms of mouthfeel, flavor, profile, and nutrient density.
Wow, that's a lot. That's amazing. Like just the way you're kind of describing the way the flavors are produced with you know, respecting the actual cultures and going through tons of rounds of iteration and working with chefs. That sounds like you've put a lot of time and energy into the flavor, which whenever you kind of survey consumers, like flavor ends up being at top of the list or very near the top of the list for their top priorities, right? So you got that dialed in. And then to your point, Americans are consuming so many potato chips, or maybe other cultures around the world too, but for sure, Americans are consuming a lot of potato chips, which, like you said, don't have a lot of nutritional value. It's just a bunch of salt and fat, basically, that we're eating. So having actual vegetables that have more vitamins, minerals, and other kind of things in there is kind of nice upgrade to nutrition. So make it taste just as good or not better, if not better than potato chips, but give people actual nutrition. And then using ugly produce, you're also preventing food waste. So there's a lot of pieces to that story, celebrating the cultures, enjoying food, a healthy and kind of sustainable play.
Thanks so much. And
Snack,
you know,
2.0s.
It's been really fun creating with them too, because like the chefs, you know, they all come from different parts of the world, our creative team as well. And you are absolutely spot on that. Like, taste is the number one thing that gets people going back, buying the same bag over and over again, hundreds of times. Like, no one really cares that you are trying to save the world or be better for you. Like, all they care about inherently is like, does this taste good? Is that going to fill me up? Is that going to satiate me? That's the most animalistic, instinctual thing that the customer is going to get the nanosecond that they walk past the snack aisle. So we only have that few seconds to get their attention. And it's really, really important that they love the taste of it.
Yeah, I often describe that journey as like the packaging needs to catch their attention, like be visually beautiful or look delicious or whatever. And then the attributes that you communicate will hopefully get them to pick it up, give you a try. The quality or the taste of your product will get them to buy it again. The sustainability or mission part, while it's not typically the first driver, the main reason people pick you up or buy you, I think that builds brand loyalty. They feel good about being loyal to your product. And then if a competitor pops up with a similar product and they don't have the mission story that you do, they'll keep buying your product. So the brand or packaging like gets them hooked or gets them to try, your product quality gets them to repeat purchase, and then your mission gets them to be loyal.
Yeah, that's pretty true. I love that hierarchy that you presented. Like the feel good effect after they purchase it, I think that is a good source of loyalty.
And it's loyalty and also helps them like spread the word, right? If you've got a really good story about your product, they not only get to tell their friends, oh my God, you got to try these, they're delicious. But hey, did you know they're also sustainable or healthier or whatever too, right? It just adds more firepower for them to spread the word for you and become part of your marketing engine.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I love Oatly a lot. They were the first pioneers in oat milk. And, you know, even though now every single brand is copying them and also launching their, you know, alternatives, you know, I think a lot of people would still be loyal to Oatly because of the story that they have and the sustainable mission that they have. Yeah, I find that really intriguing.
And the fun brand. They've also just got a lot of character to the brand that people like. I think that's something, too, that people can do. Like Apple, for example, like the way they built their brand to be creative and inspired and hip and cool, whatever. Like a lot of people buy their products, not because they need the function of those products, but just because that's the cool brand to buy, right? So there's also that, like Oatly is just a fun, irreverent brand or whatever. And like Liquid Death is a common brand that keeps getting popped up in conversation just because, you know, they launched a water, like who cares about water, but they launched with such a weird, quirky brand that they made it work. They got like people buzzing about it. Like nobody really, I'm sure some people think, oh, that product's really good though. But like, is it really that much better than any other sparkling water, right? Probably not. But they built a really compelling brand. And then they weave in the sustainability angle as like an afterthought, like death to plastic, right? So they have that plastic angle, but it's not the main thing. It's the quirky, weird, kind of niched brand that made it work.
Absolutely. And I think it's like pure marketing genius. They have like literally one SKU and it's a unicorn now. And like death to plastic is so badass as well. Like I love the whole branding. And they managed to decommoditize water. Like, can you imagine? Mineral water. I think that's like really genius. And that's what's fun about building a brand, because, you know, you have a lot of challenges every day, but then it's like a chess game. And, you know, how do we position and message and position ourselves in the market to stand out from a huge, brutal, saturated category.
Yeah, I think they took the opposite strategy that a lot of companies do, which is, I need to figure out a product that solves a problem. And they said, screw it. We're going to find a brand that will stand out in the market. And then they just went with that. And then they'll figure out the product later, right? It's kind of funny. So I'm a big fan of upcycling, as I was telling you before we started recording. Like, just it makes common sense to use all the food or as much of it as possible that we produce rather than throwing it out or, you know, like composting it or feeding it to animals or whatever. But like, we grew this food at human quality. We should consume as much of it as possible instead of letting people go hungry or just throwing it away. So I'm a big fan of the upcycling movement, and, you know, Modern Species is helping push that forward because we, as I was telling you, designed the marks and the Upcycled Food Association branding and such. So I'm a big fan, big supporter. When I was researching you and your products, I saw that you were upcycled, like you mentioned too. You're part of that association. So how did that upcycled piece become part of your brand? I know you said that you were aware of food waste. When did that awareness come into play? Was it after you started building the brand and were looking for a better way to source, or was it during your travels you saw firsthand a lot of food waste? How did that become part of your product development?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, I actually traveled a lot and visited a lot of farms. As a foodie, I really want to, you know, see different farmers markets and visit farms and see where the vegetables are grown, like where food comes from. It's very important to me, and I think, I presume, to many consumers as well. So we are all upcycled verified. When you open up a bag of confetti, it's a kaleidoscope of colors, you know, real vegetables that are very colorful. We take surpluses from orange farms and, you know, surplus mandarins that can be sold to retailers in time. And we upcycle them to a snack with a much longer shelf life to really optimize and elevate food to its highest and best use while creating a very fascinating, you know, adventurous gourmet culinary adventure for our consumers. Launching the first mandarin chip in US has been really fun. It's crunchy, delicious, zero fat, very low in calories, but it satiates the consumer and get them, you know, filled up with plant-based goodness from fruits and veggies and shiitake mushrooms, while, you know, creating a form of permissible indulgence where they can snack as much as they want and not feel guilty about it, unlike consuming a potato chip or, you know, extruded corn puff, for example. I think food businesses can be used as a force for good. You know, if we find something that is a fast-moving consumer good in a very high-velocity category, you can actually maximize a lot more millions of pounds of edible produce and prevent them from ending up in the landfill. In fact, up to 8% of human cost greenhouse emissions come from food decomposing in the landfill and creating like methane and other greenhouse gases. And that's crazy. It's preventable entirely if we actually channel these excess surpluses and imperfect foods into something useful. Yeah, I think that food waste can actually be solved as long as we have enough innovative companies thinking about it.
Again, it makes so much sense on so many different angles, I think. And it's really fast growing movement. I just saw on LinkedIn today that Food Network magazine said it's 2024 is going to be the year of upcycling, for example. And I think part of the reason that the movement is growing fast is that it isn't a compromise like, oh yeah, I guess we should be more sustainable as a company and we should switch all of our packaging because that's the right thing to do, which is important, right? But with upcycling, it makes business sense too. Like, if you're buying ingredients or growing ingredients and you throw 40% of them away, like, that's not very efficient. That's not a good way of running a business. So by trying to use more of what you're buying and either use more of it by selling the leftover bits to someone like you who's going to make chips out of them, or to a pulp pantry who's going to make crackers out of them, or using the spent grain from breweries to make, you know, flours and mixes to make, you know, pasta or bread. Like, all that just makes sense because you already bought the product. You may as well either make something out of it or sell it to someone else as an ingredient rather than just throwing it out. So I feel like it's got the sustainability angle to it, which is great. You know, it's something that we need to do for climate change and feeding the hungry and all these other kind of things. But it also just makes business sense where some other sustainability focused things are a hard decision for business because they've got to pay more to do fair trade or get organic certified or convert their land to something. But hypothetically speaking, you know, once you get past the hurdles of figuring out how you're going to take that byproduct and move it, get it into the form someone else needs, you're not paying more, right? You already paid to grow that produce. So you may as well sell the ugly stuff that a retailer doesn't want to someone making chips. Or if you're working in a food kitchen and you have a byproduct that you're normally just probably paying to throw away, you may as well just sell it. So it just makes good business sense. It makes circular economy sense, and it's just smart all around.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, you know, even for these farms, right, their product get rejected as B-grade product because, like, it's the wrong size or the wrong shape. And even though it's very delicious and healthy to eat, but they are filtered out because they don't meet perfect standards that supermarkets need. You know, even for them to dispose the surpluses or the imperfect foods, they have to spend thousands of dollars trucking it to the landfill. Like, you know, if you give it to us at a huge discount, we would help you solve your disposal issue and we'll turn it to something useful. And I think more food companies can really innovate around that. And I do feel like the whole food ecosystem is a family. So, you know, case in point is Dough. You know, we have a partnership innovating with them. Dough has a lot of plantations selling bananas, you know, avocado, pineapple. And, you know, they do have a lot of surpluses from their plantations around the world. So what happens if they can't sell the fresh produce in time? Then what happens to the stock? So we are working with them to come up like with a line of dips with mashed up fruit and then creating a confetti colorful line of dips with their surpluses, for example. So it becomes a very colorful snacking complementary product and, you know, complementary business unit that supports the existing business as well and makes it fun, you know, to secretly stuff as much fruits and vegetables into consumers' lifestyle as possible. Yeah, and to make it taste good too, because consumers need to be seduced by the taste first.
Right, and I'm getting excited about having some confetti chips with a confetti dip as well. That sounds delicious. And to your point, yeah, there's so many different angles of food waste that people don't think of. And I didn't intentionally do this, but I'm drinking a tepache beverage right now, the pineapple spice version of it. The way this is made is often from like the rind bits that you cut off the pineapple, I believe. And then you ferment it and make a beverage out of it with some spices and stuff. So technically, even like a lot of cultures, like to your point, cultures have been using byproducts of food for a very long time to make a lot of, you know, core staple recipes in those cultures. It just makes sense even culturally and flavor profile wise, right? This beverage, which is delicious, wouldn't even exist if people weren't thinking about how to use leftover scraps or the bits that you're not going to eat. You can still make a drink out of it, right? So there's so many reasons why the upcycled food movement makes sense. I love it. I also am a 1% for the Planet member and saw that you are too. So look at all this stuff we have in common here. So how did you become passionate about the planet and why did it make sense for you to join 1% for the Planet?
You know, it's the same reason why I joined Upcycle Food Association. You know, One for a Better Planet. You know, I love the brand story. I'm not sure if you read the book from the founders, like Patagonia. You know, they really felt like, you know, business genuinely could engage, you know, not only their own VCs and investors as stakeholders, but also the planet and communities. I think they were really serious about building brands like, you know, Patagonia for clothing or, you know, Pulp Pantry for snacks. I think the whole entire ecosystem is like a family. You know, how can we innovate and really contribute to the equation of helping humanity, like the people facing hunger, for example, or do something sustainable for the planet by upcycling food waste so that we are more climate focused and carbon neutral. So I wanted to partner with them because I felt like it opened up more doors in the ecosystem with like-minded brands who are very mission driven and also really focused on finding solutions to solve major problems facing the world today. You know, I think the faster we grow confetti, the more we can do to upcycle food waste and, you know, contribute to fighting hunger as well. It's not fair that many of them are starving to death and most of them are children as well. And if they don't get certain nutrition at a very young age, they have permanent, you know, connective development. Their brain health suffers. They don't grow as tall as they would like because they don't get the right nutrients. So if this becomes a global concept, we can actually upcycle millions of pounds of edible produce, prevent them from ending up wasted. We can also feed millions of mouths and prevent them from dying. And I think that's the legacy that I hope that will continue for many years to come.
One of our clients, who I can't mention the name yet because they haven't launched, but one of their give back mission that they're trying to build into the business is related to making sure that children have the right nutrition as they grow up, exactly for those reasons, right? You need all the right nutrition at certain times for your physical development and also just like mental health and everything else too. So I think that's interesting point you make there as well about just making sure we're eating more nutrient dense type foods too, right? Because I think a lot of the foods we get accustomed to eating have very few nutrients, and then we have to start taking all these supplements or having functional other foods to offset that because we don't eat real whole foods. But the fact that your foods are real fruits and vegetables in a better form will give people more of those nutrients that they need, whether adults or children. You mentioned Patagonia founder's book. So which book was it? Was it The Future of Responsible Company or Let My People Go Surfing?
Yeah, Let My People Go Surfing. One of my mentors, advisors, wanted me to read that. Kind of reminds me of what my university lecturer said for my entrepreneurship elective in university. So he was telling us that business is so much hard work and you should always aim to go from zero to a billion and a billion back to zero. So when you get to a billion brand, then you can impact millions of lives. And then before you leave this world, you donate every cent back. So that's how you leave impact in this world. And that's his homework for us.
That's cool. I hadn't heard that quote. Was that from the book or from your professor?
From my professor. But the book had a lot of parallel synergies as well. Because, you know, for the founder of Patagonia, he actually like donated most of his wealth back to buying back national parks and giving it back to the people who live in Patagonia. So that was really incredible. Like, you are actually protecting these lands and, you know, very fragile ecosystems from, you know, being endangered, or species, animal, plants from being cultivated for commercial purposes, and really protecting the land. And that's beautiful. Like, he actually donated millions of hectares back of like prime ecosystems. And that's really important. I think there's so much beauty in this world, but there are certain things that humans do that is not so good for the environment. And I think what he did describe was really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, he's often lifted up in the impact-driven community world as a great example of an impact-driven leader and entrepreneur. And I wish more billionaires, or maybe in the future trillionaires, were like that, where a lot of them have like a pact where they're going to give away a certain percentage of their wealth. But what it typically boils down to, from what I've heard, I'm no expert on this subject, but from what I've heard, is like the amount that they actually give away per year is actually more or less just the amount that they need to give away to write off and not pay taxes. So it's like, it sounds like, oh, look, I'm being a philanthropist, but really it's just they're minimizing their taxes. Whereas someone like Yvon Chouinard actually just gave away like the whole business, right? He wasn't trying to avoid taxes. He just literally wanted to help the people or help the planet. So I think there's a difference between someone giving a few percent in their billions of dollars away and somebody who's literally just saying, I don't need all this stuff. The planet does, or my people do. So I think that's amazing. Great example.
Yeah, very moving as well. There's a documentary as well, I think on Hulu, about this. It's so touching. And I think the next generation of founders, like, it's no easier time to be a billion, to form a billion dollar brand. You know, we have every resource on our mouse or on our keypad. Like, there's no excuse for our generation not to make something of ourselves and create something tangible. And I think that if there's like more support for young founders and, you know, and people are really driven to create something like that, yeah, I think it will really change the world in a much more tangible way. And, you know, examples like him, like the Patagonia founder, is really what drives mission-driven founders to also like follow his lead as well. So I'm really glad that I read the book and watched that documentary.
Yeah, what I love about it is that it shows that it's possible. One, you can do good and build a, you know, successful business. And then also that doing good is also good for business. So like, his doing good helped him grow a big business, but then he can also grow that big business while doing good, which the reason I say that is when you're an impact-driven entrepreneur, non-impact entrepreneurs are often looking at you being like, oh, that's never going to work, because how are you going to make money if you're giving it all away? But like, I think what's great about Patagonia is that they proved you can make significant profits and give them away if you want, but you can still build a like really thriving business. What was the documentary called? Do you remember?
I can't remember now. I watched it like many months ago, but that was really moving. They were also talking about the different people who led up to Patagonia succeeding, because he was actually, I think, mountain climbing in Yosemite or something. And then he founded it with another co-founder. It was the whole story around it and extremely moving. I think there was a foundation and then, you know, it was a tribute to him after his death as well. So that was really moving.
And speaking of entrepreneurs who give back, I saw on your website that you have a Color for Hunger program. How did that come about and how does it work?
Yes, it's really exciting because, you know, I founded Confetti because I love people. I love food. You know, when I cook for people and my friends, I love to see them happy. And during the pandemic, a lot of people were suffering because they were in lockdowns. They were stuck at home, feeling, you know, miserable. And I was thinking, like, is there anything I can do to cheer them up? And I felt like, you know, what makes me happy is when I'm creating, when I'm coloring, when I'm creating art. Art is really strong and it's very therapeutic. So we actually launched that coloring contest so that people can color at home. Because of all these like beautiful fruits and vegetable inspired mandalas and coloring postcards and bookmarks, you know, it's something that they can keep, you know, send a message of love to their friends and loved ones that they can't see, maybe because they're expats. It also reminds them to eat their fruits and vegetables. It's something that they can keep as well. So for kids, they loved it because they can exchange the bookmarks and the postcards with their classmates. And, you know, we didn't expect it to really, you know, create so much momentum. So Fable Castle came in to sponsor the art competition. You know, thousands of entries came in. We had so many parents thanking us for this initiative because their kids were driving them crazy at home. You know, everyone was stuck at home. They were like, oh my God, thanks for doing this. It kept my kid entertained for 6 hours and they were just coloring. The whole entire branding about Confetti is about celebrating colors. So working with a coloring pencil company like Fable Castle and also making sheets that celebrate fruits and vegetables was really on brand for us too.
Sounds like a fun initiative. And I feel like sometimes the best initiatives that a company launches are not ones that were based on all this data and marketing research and strategy. It was just kind of popped up in their heads. It's part of their passion. It's part of the mission. It fits in with the brand. Like you said, Confetti's all about color. So just launching that program and seeing what happens and then getting that amazing response just shows how authentic it was to your brand, right?
And I think a lot of fun as well because people were so creative. You know, we had people actually not using color as a medium. They actually use textiles and like intricately spend many days putting like different colors of textiles and fabric onto the coloring sheet to win in terms of creativity. So that was a really fun initiative. And I think it was a moment of light and happiness in a very dark time. And also very important as well, because in the pandemic, you know, you need to treat your body right and really feed it with good stuff like fruits and vegetables. And I think a lot of people need to be reminded to eat their fruits and veggies. And in a very subtle, you know, psychological way, we are also reminding them to eat their colors of the rainbow. Yeah, and we use that as a fundraising campaign to raise money for the World Food Program by United Nations. The rates of hunger deaths, hunger fatalities, malnutrition skyrocketed during the pandemic because, you know, food was not so accessible. We wanted to also raise money to make sure that we can cater more products, more snacks, and more money for hunger relief in those countries as well, which were really suffering.
And is that program still going on or was that?
Yeah, it's closed now. So we are going to relaunch it in summer for the first time this year in US. So hopefully we have a very colorful, you know, Confetti summer. And then we'll relaunch it again in US and Singapore this summer.
Well, that's exciting. So listeners, stay tuned for the next launch of the coloring competition. Love it. So you're 5 years into the business now, I believe, based on your LinkedIn profile, at least. What have been your biggest lessons learned so far?
Yes. So 6 years. The biggest lessons is that actually I'm an OCD perfectionist. So I really care about how something looks, you know, the aesthetic feel of it, the brand story we are telling, you know, like having a right brand is very important. So we are very fortunate to have a team of talents. You know, Michael Kravitz is our really, really talented creative director based in New York City. You know, he created the brand story for us. He has a way of, you know, not consciously, but doing it in his own rare genius way, where he creates something that appeals emotionally to end consumers in the nanoseconds that they walk past. And, you know, with our creative team and our designers, how can we not become a commodity? You know, vegetable and fruit chips are a commodity. So the further we are about selling a product, but more selling a brand instead and creating that genuine, authentic, emotional connection to our end consumers is the biggest lesson that I've learned. You know, it's not about the actual product, but sometimes, you know, the biggest asset for most food companies is actually the brand. Like how Nike doesn't sell shoes, they sell ambition, just do it. You know, and nothing is impossible by Adidas. They're not selling shoes. Like Coca-Cola doesn't sell soda, they sell happiness. So every brand that have really succeeded and had longevity for many decades are the ones that can sell emotion the best. So that's my biggest lesson learned.
That's a good note. I went to a presentation once where somebody talked about where the value of a brand comes from. And there's the tangible, like on the books, assets, or, you know, maybe your supply chain or some trademarks that you own, like stuff like that, that you can quantify a dollar amount around. But he said, when you look at some of the big acquisitions or sales, and I think he at the time was using Instagram as an example because they had recently been purchased by Facebook at that point, or Meta now. And he was saying, what is the book value of Instagram? He was like, you know, crunching some loose numbers. And then he's like, and what did it sell for? And then he took the percentage that wasn't on the book's value. And it was something like 80, 90% or something like that of the value that the business sold for was the brand. It's the intangible stuff. It's the reason people are staying on that platform instead of jumping off to some other platform. It's the feel people get when they pop on there. It's the loyalty or the time that people are consuming on there. It's the recognizability of the mark. It's like all those kind of things, like you're saying, drive so much value in a brand that at the end of the day is what people remember, like more so often than the products.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I would go further to add on that point, being that if you have a very strong brand like Oatly or Haagen-Dazs or Ben & Jerry's, you can afford to charge a premium. And as a startup, we don't have economies of scale that the big boys have. We can't compete on them on cost or price for many years to come. So we have to be premium so that we can survive and keep our margins and thrive as a company. So having a strong brand allows you to charge a premium and market it as a premium brand. I would always choose Oatly. I don't care if there's 100 oat milk companies now. I would always choose Oatly. I don't mind paying $2 more for Oatly because I care about that brand. I care about what they stand for. In fact, I love their marketing. You know, their CEOs have been dressed up as a cow, making fun of himself. And I just feel like the whole branding is genius. And consumers don't mind paying a few dollars more for something that they love. And that's why the real emotional value of a brand comes through in terms of like brand equity.
Right. Yeah, there's so many examples of that, like Lululemon or Apple or other things like that. Like people buy the product. They could find a similar product, right, somewhere else, like similar build, just as good a quality, good support, you know, whatever. But they buy the name brand or the brand that they love because there's that emotional connection, like you were saying before, to that brand, but also a trust, right? Because that's ultimately, at the end of the day, what brand building's about is like that trust, like you're making certain promises or claims of like, this is what we care about. This is what we stand for. This is what you can expect from us. And people will pay more to get the thing that they believe or trust will deliver that value. Whereas if you look at the discount brand on the shelf next to Oatly, you might be like, oh, I could save $3, but what if it's horrible? Or I don't know anything about this company. I don't know what they stand for. You know, like it just starts opening all these questions in your mind because you don't know them. You don't trust them.
You know, you have been in Modern Species for 15 years now. I think that, do you feel also that people choose brands is also a reflection of their own personal identity? I am a Lululemon person. I am a Oatly drinker. You know, it speaks to my own identity as well, the brands I choose to consume.
Yeah, I think so. And there's a whole concept called conspicuous consumption too, where sometimes people buy brands not just, you know, privately because they feel like they have affinity for that brand, which does happen a lot, but sometimes they buy the brand because of also what it says about them. So for example, the Prius sold really well early on, even though it was an ugly, ugly car, but people bought it because it signaled their virtues to the world. It said, I am a sustainable person, so I'm going to buy this terrible, it was a well-built car, but like terrible looking car. I'm going to look like a fool driving this thing because I care about the world. Or Tom's shoes, same kind of thing. They weren't necessarily the most comfortable shoes or anything in the world, but people bought them because it said, look, I'm doing something good for the world. I'm purchase of these shoes, you know, bought some other kids some shoes around the world. So there's like that conspicuous consumption part where people buy something because they want to be associated with those values or that lifestyle or something like that. Like they buy their Gucci bag, not because they are wealthy, but because they want to look like they're successful, right? So there's those kind of conspicuous consumption things. But I think even under a deeper level below that, people are going to buy what makes them feel good about themselves, right? And if you see yourself in that brand, well, you're probably going to buy it.
It's so interesting how like choosing certain brands speak to our identity. And yeah, I have so much more to learn in US. I've just moved here last summer, so I'm just here for about a year now. I'm still learning a lot about the consumer mindset in America and how Americans think and feel towards the brands that they buy.
Yeah, Americans are weird creatures. But once you figure out like what makes them tick, then to your point, it's easier design interventions that like help them make the right choices. So part of what we focus on at Modern Species is only supporting the companies that are trying to produce something better for the world, right? Like healthier, just more regenerative, like those kind of qualities. Consumers don't naturally always gravitate towards that. Like you were saying before, they're going to choose taste over sustainability most of the time. But how do we take a sustainable brand that probably is tasty, has good quality, et cetera, and make it appealing to that consumer who would maybe otherwise buy some Cheetos? Like, how do you get the Cheetos person to buy confetti, right? So that's a big part of what we try to focus on is we want the good guys to outcompete the quote unquote bad guys, the bad products that are unhealthy, unsustainable, and so on and so forth. So that's our whole focus is how do you get people to like that brand enough to want to purchase that brand, to give them a try and then be loyal to that brand?
Yeah, that's the $1 billion question.
That was we covered a lot there. How can listeners support you? Like, what can they do to help Confetti achieve your goals and mission?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of innovation now with upcycled food products and beverage products. Yeah, to share Confetti specifically and show how delicious upcycled snacks can be because it's made from real vegetables and fruit. And, you know, we can be found in our website, confettisnacks.com, and also Amazon US. We have also launched in 5 countries in Europe, namely London, Austria, Germany, Holland, and Poland. We also are launching in Hawaii soon, and also like GNC Mexico, which is a chain of health stores. We are also in a lot of about 3,000 locations now of home goods, independent specialty stores, launching with Walmart, Festival Foods and Heinen's this summer. And, you know, we got voted the favorite snack of Netflix employees. So we catered to their offices. And I think with more people going back to work now, you know, we would love a chance to supply your offices as well with upcycled snacks. And people are traveling more now. So like hotels, you know, we are currently in luxury hotels like JW Marriott, Hilton Group, Mandarin Oriental and St. Regis. So, you know, any park or hotel office that would love to have this range of plant-based upcycled snacks, you know, we would love to supply to them.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. A lot of brands forget to think about those markets, the hotels, the offices, the airlines, like all those kind of things. But those are great markets for exposure to your brand because those people try your product at that hotel, fall in love with it, and go home and buy a bunch of it, right? So that's a smart angle.
Thank you. And it's also no slotting fees as well. A lot of supermarkets charge slotting fees for you to be on the shelf. But then when you do a contract like with the government or with offices, it just renews every annual, like annual contracts. And then the employees get to taste it. And it's kind of like free advertising for us as well.
I didn't think about that angle. Smart. So if you have a few more minutes, I'd love to just do a quick rapid round question segment to wrap up.
Yes, absolutely.
feel free to answer these super short or give a little flavor detail if you want. First off, what's your favorite veggie? I know you feature a lot of them in your products, so maybe it's hard to pick your favorite, but do you have a favorite?
Yes, I love asparagus. So I would say like crunchy asparagus with like, you know, upcycled scallops and sour cream and dill would be amazing. So, you know, we are experimenting on all kinds of different exotic fruits and veggies, but my favorite is asparagus hands down.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I just had some really delicious asparagus the other day because it's spring and it's asparagus season.
So, yes.
Love it. Now, I know you've traveled to a ton of countries, at least on that trip, 40-something, but probably a lot more since then. If you could live in any other city around the world, which would you choose?
I would choose Nouméa. It's the capital of New Caledonia, which is my favorite country in the world. I've never been in some place that was really like, you know, when I say breathtaking, I literally mean that I forget to breathe. You know, it has the highest lighthouse in the world, and I'm a huge scuba diver and paraglider. So when I was on top of that beautiful lighthouse and looking down, you know, it was just a fascinating kaleidoscope of colors, of coral and marine life. I've never seen anything like that before. It literally took my breath away. It also has the longest lagoon in the world and the most number of black and white sea stripes, sea snakes. So it's just incredible. Like when you are swimming in it, it's like diving in an aquarium. And it's also really off the tourist path. So there's like very little tourists there.
Good shout out for New Caledonia there. And if anyone from there is listening, if you want more impact-driven entrepreneurs to move there, you've got a good candidate here.
Yay. I would love to move there. Yeah, it's just like really paradise on earth.
I'll have to put it on my travel list. Okay, so what's the best piece of advice you've received recently?
I read a quote very recently. I think it might be from Charles Darwin, where he said that, you know, it's not the strongest and the most intelligent that survive in terms of species, but the ones that are most adaptable. And I think it's very similar to business as well. It's not whether you have the most financial muscle or that you are the most intelligent, but I think that it's really the brands that survive in the long run are the ones that adapt to market forces in the most flexible way.
I love that. And also partly because it's a good plug for Modern Species, because Modern Species, the name behind or the idea behind the brand is that we help our brands evolve to the current times, whether it's to be more sustainable or to meet the consumer demand, tell their story better, et cetera. So we believe in constant evolution, which is part of being adaptable. So I love that. Okay, so who's an impact-driven leader you admire and why? And maybe let's remove Yvon Chouinard from the list since we already said that, unless that's your answer you prepared. But do you have another one?
Yeah, I love Daniel Lubetzi. He was the guest judge in Shark Tank and he founded Kind Bars. I learned so much from him. I mean, he literally travels to every plane, every train that he takes. He travels with a whole bag full of Kind Bars to sample out, which speaks to the importance of sampling as a food brand. But he wrote a book called Do the Kind Thing, which I think I must have read 5 times. It's so impactful. Yeah, I mean, he started first company to solve the conflict between Israel and Gaza. And then, you know, he really felt like if people were trade partners to each other, they wouldn't try to kill each other. And that's really smart. Then after that, you know, when he was hustling in that tomato, I think pasta sauce company, you know, he was actually always running on empty and he wanted a snack that couldn't fuel him when he was having crazy days. And that's how he started Kind Bars, you know, very single ingredient bars that are delicious and you can see through and see exactly what's inside. You know, such a simple concept. It's not as if I can't go and start a nut company tomorrow. It's so easy to replicate, but because of the emotional appeal of the way he branded it, the whole story and mission behind it, I think that because of that, you know, they make, I think, above $1 billion every year and, you know, scaled to 300,000 locations. And I think it's a very successful, inspiring story of something so simple that if executed well in the marketplace can become a very strong national brand.
Right. Yeah. And relevant to yours too, right? Like better for you snack. So love that. Okay. So last question, what does a better world mean to you? Since that's the name of our podcast is Brands for a Better World, I like to finish with that one.
Yeah, I think that this modern species, you know, pun intended, is very intelligent. You know, we have all the creativity and mind power in this world. You know, we should really elevate that, bring it very strong innovation in the food world. you know, not really producing more food, but more in an intelligent way and elevate it creativity. And I think that it all starts with creating strong businesses. So a better world would have founders who would keep continuing on to create billion-dollar brands that change the world. They should be very ambitious, and they should really have strong mentors, ecosystems to support them so that we create even more thought leaders of tomorrow who can go on to create more billion-dollar brands. And I think that we as a species, you know, we have the intelligence and creativity to do that, to create businesses that solve major problems facing the world today.
I love that. And because I feel like that's actually the ultimate purpose of a business. I think we've changed the purpose of a business through like venture capital and other things, where it went from the only reason businesses got started in the first place is because there was a problem that needed to be solved. People needed this type of product they could trust or whatever. So a business was created to be able to create that product and deliver that need, like serve that need. But then like when people who didn't care about that problem started pumping money into businesses, and now they just force those businesses to make as much money as possible by cutting the quality of the product or paying their workers less or whatever, then we lost the purpose. We lost the sight of what a business is, which is basically just a solution to a community problem, right? And then it just became more about like, I want money, so I'm going to put money in and force you to ruin everything that made your business good in order to make more money. And I think we need to go back to, why don't we just make money, a reasonable amount of money, off of solving problems? And if we just go back to that, then business isn't a negative thing. You know, capitalism doesn't have to be a negative thing. We just need to do it the right way. So I love that answer.
Yeah. And I think if we align everyone's interests, I think we'll get there.
Well, this was a really fun conversation. Sorry, I kept you a little long. I realize went a bit long on this episode, but it was so fascinating to chat with you and hear more about your story. And I love the mission you're putting out into the world and everything you're doing to try to change the business landscape and make healthier snacks.
Thanks so much, Gage, for having me. Really a huge pleasure being here and learning from you as well.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about Betty or Confetti, visit confettisnacks.com. If you like this show, remember to help us grow by liking, reviewing, and sharing. If you're new here, don't forget we have over 100 episodes in the archive. Some might be called Evolve CPG, but it's the same show, so dig in for more goodness. If you consider yourself an impact-driven professional, join me over at impactdriven.community, where we're supporting each other's growth as impact leaders.